This podcast was recorded at the 2016 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is Best Practices in the Management of Infectious Complications for Patients with Cancer, and it is presented by James S. Lewis II, Oregon Health and Science University. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
I'm delighted to have our next speaker join us. Please welcome Dr. James Lewis of the Oregon Health and Science University as he discusses best practices in the management of infectious complications for cancer patients. Welcome.
We're going to have a good time talking about infectious complications in cancer, and we're going to spend some time specifically talking about these learning objectives right here. Now, you are all advanced practitioners, therefore I have extremely high levels of faith in your ability to read, and I am not going to read these lovely learning objectives to you. Here are my disclosures. You can read those as well. Again, I have no questions about your reading skills. So let's cut to the chase. How many of you have used biosimilar filgrastim at this point? Cool. That's about what I expected. So biosimilar filgrastim was really the first of the biosimilars that we've seen come to the market in the United States. As we sit in this room today, we currently have four biosimilars that have been approved by the FDA at this point in time. It is anticipated that by 2020, this market has a potential to be up to a $4 billion a year market just in the United States. And the reason for that is that the agents that we're talking about tend to be very expensive progenitor agents, and then what we're noticing is that the biosimilars as they come along, because of the complexity of manufacturing and then some other things that we're going to discuss, the prices come down somewhat, but they're not coming down huge at this point in time. Now, when you talk about biosimilars versus generics, one of the big questions I get is, all right, aren't biosimilars generics? There's nobody here from the FDA, is there? Because I'll tell you right now, it looks like, it barks like, it smells like, it pretty much is a generic, okay? But unfortunately, what has happened is, when we talk about generics, as we're used to thinking about them, they're small molecules. They're easy to make, they're easy to verify, you know, and so really, they're fairly straightforward. And really, what you see with the biosimilars is that you have extremely large, extremely complicated molecules that are actually produced typically from living systems. They're proteins. They're massive. And so the complexity of the molecule is much different than anything that we've seen before as far as our standard generics go. But really, for a lot of the other intents and purposes, you should think of them as generics. You just should think of them as really, really complicated generics is what this boils down to. The other thing that I want to make abundantly clear as we move through and talk about the biosimilars for filgrastim here is that really, you have to understand that unlike generics at this point in time, these are not easily interchangeable. You can't just flip back and forth at this point in time. And that's because of the pathway that was put together for the approval of biosimilars and how the wording works. Now, let's be real here. If you accidentally switch up a dose of biosimilar filgrastim for the original filgrastim, are you going to hurt the patient? No. In all likelihood, you are absolutely not going to hurt the patient because you still need to remember that these drugs to get to market have been through extensive screening through the FDA, and the FDA puts them through a ton of hoops. But because these molecules are so big, so complicated, and have some subtle structural differences, and there's not a lot of experience with them at this point in time, the recommendation remains that they should not be interchangeable. Okay, so whatever agent starts a patient's regimen should ideally be what you stick with through the remainder of the therapy. As we stand here and talk about biosimilars today, no, none, zip, zero, zilch of the four approved biosimilars are considered interchangeable by the FDA. All right, that's a very, very important point to make. And so that's one of the major differences that we see between biosimilars and generics. And when you look again at the structure of the molecules, on the right is a molecule that probably you're very familiar with, cefepime, our favorite fourth generation cephalosporin in febrile neutropenia. On the left is the chemical structure of filgrastim. Which one of those would you like to try and make? Right? I will tell you that the cefepime molecule is way, 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 way easier. And that's really the challenge with the biosimilars. You can have the same amino acid sequences, but the proteins maybe fold a little bit different, or, you know, there may be something that's just a smidge different. But what you need to remember at the end of the day is that in order to be called a biosimilar, there's been extensive pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic work. The structure, the amino acid sequence is the same. These things are virtually identical, but there are subtle differences because of the complexity of the molecules that are not felt to be clinically relevant, okay? So that's why there's still a little bit of hesitancy about switching back and forth, and why we really want to stick with, you know, if you go with the biosimilar out of the gate, stick with that through the remainder of the patient's therapy. If you start with the brand name, stick with that through the remainder of the patient's therapy. This is, again, just kind of looking at all of the various steps that go into producing large, complex protein products like we're used to seeing with biosimilars and all the other mAbs, mIbs, et cetera, that you all deal with, and why they're so much more complicated to deal with than the small molecule generics that we're used to dealing with. What have we seen in the market with regards to filgrastim versus what that's done with Neupogen? Well, you can actually see here some numbers that I pulled from Amgen's quarterly report as to what the impact of biosimilar filgrastim in the United States has been thus far. What you'll notice is that total sales are still on pace to basically do $600 million in the U.S. Not a bad number, but realize that's down somewhat substantially. There's the two biosimilars that we've talked about there, although realize that TBO filgrastim is not technically a biosimilar. It's actually something that was approved prior to the 2010 regulatory pathway for biosimilars, and it only has the one indication. That bottom line on this slide, I think, is very telling. And this is why I think more of you didn't raise your hand. The challenge that we see with biosimilars is, again, we're still kind of trying to figure out the wording. We're still trying to figure out payer structures and whatnot. But because of that, and because of the fact that the acquisition cost for your pharmacy isn't that much cheaper, there hasn't been a huge run. You know, typically what we see with generics is you can see up to 50 to 75% decreases in price within the first 12 to 18 months after a generic hits the market. What we've seen with the biosimilars is that maybe it's a 10 to 20% decrease in price. So the financial incentive to move hasn't been quite as forceful as it might have been with a generic, plus some of the confusion about biosimilars. If you look out there, when you say biosimilar to a lot of physicians and a lot of providers, they're still not sure what that means. So, you know, I think we have a long way to go with education, and I think that there are a variety of issues that have really kind of kept us from seeing rapid acceptance of the biosimilar filgrastim into the market. All right, so that's kind of a little bit of background on what biosimilars are, kind of where we stand and what's going on from an economic standpoint. Let's talk a little bit about where we're going clinically with these things. So basically what the guidelines have to say, and again, these are taken from the NCCN guidelines, the 2016 version, so they're readily available to you online. If you have not gone around and dug in the NCCN guidelines section on the web, I would strongly encourage you to do it. There is really a broad scope and depth of guidelines available on that website, and they're very concisely written. They're easily searchable because they're in PDF form, and so they work very, very nicely. One of the things that the guidelines say with regards to biosimilars that I think is important is that really you notice here that the GCSF now refers to all of these approved agents. All right, so the guidelines have moved wholesale over to basically saying when we say GCSF, we're talking about any of these products. So what you see right there is that the guidelines have already really taken them up and accepted them. They say in here that biosimilars can be substituted for the originator product. product. But again, it's very important to realize that they go on and say if it's been considered interchangeable by the FDA. And again, remember, none of the currently available biosimilars have been considered interchangeable at this point in time. So whatever regimen you start with is really what your patient should complete therapy with. Again, recommending that patients remain on the same product throughout treatment. And again, making the comment down here that it is not an interchangeable product for you. So what are some of the challenges that we face with some of these biosimilars and filgrastim as we move forward? It's really unlikely that we're ever going to see phase 3 trials with these, okay? Because really all the FDA is requiring is head-to-head data showing that the product is equivalent to what you have out there. And so going back and doing a full phase 3 trial would be really expensive and so probably not terribly interesting to a lot of the manufacturers. So our data is then being extrapolated from kind of some of the early head-to-head safety data to other indications. Guys, that's fine. I mean, don't get hung up on that. You know, and I think with the number of hands that I saw go up in the room already, one of the things that I've heard is, oh, but, you know, we don't actually have data in that indication. Come on. Come on. You have the same amino acid sequences. You have all kinds of PK/PD workup by the agency. You know these drugs are going to work. And so I really, really don't like a lot of these comments, although I understand why we have to do it in an area where we're dealing with these new agents. I mean, saying that we should be sitting around making decisions on appropriate incorporation, the drug is way cheaper. How many of your patients enjoy getting bills that are 20% higher than they need to be? You know, so again, I really think that we should be encouraging rapid integration of these biosimilars into our product. And, you know, they basically say that the biosimilars have some variation in manufacturing. Again, remember that the standard of the FDA is holding these agents to really accounts for a lot of what we're talking about here. You're talking about what the FDA by definition says is insignificant differences between the compounds. They're not felt to be clinically relevant at all. Should we pay attention to them since we've not used these molecules before? Absolutely we should. But it shouldn't be a situation where we're basically costing our institutions and our patients considerable money by not moving in these. And I really don't necessarily agree that these could result in differences in efficacy because, again, you have to prove a lot of that to get the biosimilar tag. The safety thing, a lot of safety signals don't pop up until way late in the game, right? We've seen this with antibiotics for years. Think about quinolones. Quinolones have a brand spanking new black box warning. Ciprofloxacin has been on the market since 1986. So when you start to get into safety signals, you have to realize that a lot of times they happen very, very infrequently, and it's going to be years before you see anything really pop up from a safety signal. So I don't worry about efficacy at all with regards to the biosimilars. And the safety, okay, you know, we can talk about that. But remember how structurally similar these molecules have to be. And again, we will see these move, we will see a lot of experience with these as we move forward because of the less expensive nature of the compound. The FDA-approved indications that you have for the biosimilar filgrastim are exactly the same as what you have for Neupogen. Again, no difference there whatsoever. Notice that TBO filgrastim, because it was approved prior to the biosimilar pathway, only has one indication, and that's reduction in the duration of severe neutropenia in non-myeloid malignancies. Filgrastim indications are basically exactly the same as the biosimilar indications, which tells you what the FDA thinks of the similarities between these two molecules. So, when you think about these clinically, who should we be giving these agents to? Who should be getting myeloid growth factors? The big thing that really should drive this is the intensity of the chemo regimen. The harder you're going to smack them and the more marrow toxic that these agents are, the deeper the neutropenia is likely to become, the more likely you are to really need to be using these agents in prophylaxis type settings. Any chemo regimen or any patient who has felt to have a higher than 20% risk of febrile neutropenia is recommended to receive myeloid growth factors as prophylaxis. Again, the type of chemo regimen and other risk factors. When you start talking about other risk factors, what I really want to draw your attention to is right down here. Once again, we know that getting old is dangerous. All right? Find me any disease state where, when studied, getting older results in a better outcome. Okay, I cannot think of one. I'm sure someone in this brilliant room will, but I can't come up with one. But so if you have an older patient who's receiving big time chemo, and then they've had previous chemo or radiotherapy, pre-existing neutropenia or a tumor involvement of the bone marrow, or poor performance status and a bunch of comorbidities. You know, so again, the more frail the patient becomes, the more they've been around the block, the more their marrow has been hit, the more you need to be thinking about these. Because again, we know that when these agents are used in the appropriate patients, they reduce infection rates, they reduce hospitalizations, they reduce length of stay. There's a lot of upside here. The downside that you will hear repeatedly is spot on correct. They are expensive. These are big cash money drugs, which is again why the biosimilars have gotten so much attention. Because 20% less of a big number is a big number, right? And that's really what is getting a lot of pharmacy directors' attentions and whatnot. So, again, thinking about which folks should be receiving these agents, really this is what you're looking for right here. Again, with the understanding that comorbidities, frailty, types of tumor, etc., also do this. The other thing to notice is that all of your major oncology organizations really kind of agree here, and that's always nice when the smart people basically can agree on what to do. The intermediate risk, folks, it's a little bit trickier, but I'll tell you right now, if it's my mom or dad, I think I'm going with it. Because again, really the data that's out there suggests that you decrease infection rates, you decrease length of stay, you decrease duration of neutropenia. Now again, one of the pushbacks that you'll hear sometimes is, yeah, but there's no evidence of improved mortality. Guys, the bad news is, these don't treat the malignancy. Okay, so one of the problems with really hanging up on mortality as an endpoint is that malignancy comes with a pretty high rate of mortality in and of itself. And so I'm not sure that mortality is really the best endpoint for us to be looking at with these compounds. What about people who are sick and come in? What should we be doing with myeloid growth factors in patients who are infected? This is where the data really starts to get dicey. I think most people really kind of agree that prophylaxis use in high-risk patients makes a lot of sense and that the data is fairly substantial. The therapeutic use of myeloid growth factors in patients who are actually infected is a much more dicey area and an area where it's harder to find good data. So it's much less well supported by the evidence. But again, what we seem to see in these studies is that it's associated with a shorter length of stay. It's also associated with a shorter duration of neutropenia. However, you're not, again, seeing necessarily a decrease in mortality. There is some suggestion of a decrease in infection-related mortality, which to my way of thinking is really all you can ask these compounds to do. The other thing that I want to point out, we bumped into this a couple times in our cancer patients up in Oregon. If somebody is on pegfilgrastim, remember that that's like an every 3-week dose. If someone comes in infected and has received a dose of that, there is absolutely no benefit to doing anything with regards to giving them further growth factor in order to try and improve neutropenia recovery. It's just not going to be a benefit at all, and all it's going to do is add cost to the patients. So again, when you think about patients who are presenting with active infections, one of the things, or what the patients who I think that really you should be considering myeloid growth factors in, are in this list right here. Again, folks over the age of 65, if they also, and before I go any further, let me stop there. Notice here, did not receive myeloid growth factor prophylaxis. If they've been receiving myeloid growth factor prophylaxis, continue it. If they got pegfilgrastim, don't hit them with another dose. But if they've not been seeing this at all and they come in septic, especially with an ANC of less than 100 or a neutropenia that's expected to last longer than 10 days, I think you can make a very good argument for myeloid growth factors in these patients. If they have pneumonia, especially if they have invasive fungal infections or other some kind of tough to treat infections, really those are the areas that I would think I would encourage you to think long and hard about the use of these compounds. When you look at them for stem cell transplant, again, really what they're primarily used for is mobilization of the peripheral stem cells, and also are used somewhat after transplant. But realize that this is a controversial area and not all centers necessarily agree on this. They are recommended though routinely as supportive care post-transplant. Now, that whole discussion, that whole discussion around filgrastim is because there are certainly situations where having white cells is a really, really good thing. Okay? And this person back here sneezing clearly needs more white cells. See what happens when your white cells leave you? You end up with a cold. Okay? So really, and some of the reasons that I am a huge white cell fan, are these guys right here. One of the things that we are seeing nationally and internationally is really the emergence of a variety of bacterial pathogens that we've seen before, but now they're nastier. You know, if you go back 20 years and you come up to me and you say, Jim, what's the rate of carbapenem resistance in Klebsiella? I'd be like, zero. Okay, but now do you realize that in New York City, depending on which hospital you're in, up to 40% of Klebsiella isolates are now carbapenem resistant? And for those of you who checked out of pharmacology a little bit early, bad move. Okay, remember that the carbapenems are the bazookamycins or the Godzilla-cillins of the antibacterial world. Okay, they are kill-em-all-a-mycin, for lack of a better term. When you're carbapenem resistant, you're resistant to all of your beta-lactams. Your penicillins just died. Your cephalosporins just died. Your carbapenems just died. Your aztreonam just died. Doesn't leave you with much, does it? And really, therein lies our problem. And I think one of the things that I'm increasingly becoming a growth factor fan for is that prevention of infection. Because infection leads to antibiotics. Antibiotics lead to this. Okay? The only way that we have ever won in infectious diseases is through vaccines. That's the only time that the bacteria or the viruses have ever gone, too good. You win. Peace out. Okay? Do you guys see we just eradicated measles from the Americas? I almost said the Northern Hemisphere, but that's not right. So we basically eradicated measles from the Americas until someone doesn't get vaccinated and goes to Europe and flies home. Okay? But, you know, vaccines work. The antibacterials, the bugs don't quit. While we're sitting here, the bugs are listening to us talk and they're thinking about ways to get around the antibiotics that we are talking about. You know, we say that bugs don't have brains. If any of you have ever looked at the mechanism behind vancomycin resistance in Enterococcus, they have brains. We just haven't found them. Okay, because those steps, it's way too complicated. But what we are seeing is a rapid emergence of organisms that are increasingly difficult to treat. And remember, 80%, 80, of the antibiotics that you have available to manage your patients are beta-lactams. So when you start saying all the beta-lactams are dead, think about what that does to your therapeutic armamentarium right there. Okay, so I mean, the resistance in these organisms is extremely challenging. This is a list that comes to us from the CDC and is some of the things that they are concerned about. How many of you are just over C. diff? I mean, you're so sick of C. diff, you can't even see straight, right? I am telling you right now, C. diff is, you know, do you know C. diff is right now the number one healthcare associated infection in the United States? Number one. And no matter what we do not seem to be able to get our C. diff rates down in Oregon. So, you know, really, I think this is a huge challenge. It is definitely associated with excess mortality. Carbapenem resistant Enterobacteriaceae. When you have E. coli and Klebsiella resistant to carbapenems, you know you are having a bad day, okay? And unfortunately, your types of patients are the patients who show up with these organisms. They've had round after round of antibiotics because they're chronically ill, they're debilitated, they've seen chemotherapy, they have plastic in place, you know, basically all of the things that set them up for recurrent infections. They have tumors squeezing on organs that don't like to be squeezed on, you know, things like that that result in problems. Now, drug-resistant gonorrhea, we can tell lots of jokes about that over break, but we're not actually going to be too concerned about that. But where you guys, again, should be concerned, multi-resistant Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter. Realize when we talk about febrile neutropenia that historically the bug that terrified us was Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Pseudomonas aeruginosa, it's mean, it's green, and it eats everything, is what you need to remember. Okay, the stuff can live in jet fuel. And really, what we see now is that we're seeing more and more Pseudomonas strains emerging with resistance to a variety of antibacterials. ESBL-producing Enterobacteriaceae, E. coli, anywhere you go, is the number one gram-negative organism. And so substantial resistance in E. coli is going to result in a lot of problems. Your quinolone prophylaxis that we use widely in some of our more profoundly compromised patients. Have you noticed the E. coli's coming in when people are on quinolone prophylaxis? They're always quinolone resistant, aren't they? And you can hear them laughing at you, which is very insulting. But it's another reason that we need a vaccine. So, when you think about antibiotic resistant bacteria, you know, basically what the CDC estimates is that more than 2 million illnesses and at least 23,000 deaths are attributable to this in the United States every year. If we can get our infection control right, and if we can do a better job of being antibiotic stewards, it's estimated that we could potentially have 70% fewer patients than estimated develop CRE infections in the next five years. The problem with CRE, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, is that it's not just carbapenem-resistant. It's pan-beta-lactam-resistant. They're typically quinolone-resistant. They're typically aminoglycoside-resistant. They're basically nightmare bugs, for lack of a better term. And they're very problematic in certain geographic locales and in certain hospitals. But again, one of the things I think we need to be better at in healthcare in this area is we need to be better at integrating our systems. We can be absolutely awesome in our hospital, but if the hospital down the street doesn't wash their hands and sends us their patients, we're going to have the same problems they have. Some great data that came out of Chicago, when you move patients from nursing home A to nursing home B, back to the inpatient side, to another hospital, over to this nursing home, that patient's bugs go with them everywhere. Okay, so we need better systems to allow us to track patients who are moving from institution to institution with resistant organisms. These are the types of challenges that we're talking about. So, and I want to back up here real quick. And really, you know, the problem is that we know that oncology is where all the money is. And we can have some interesting debates about how long that's sustainable, but I figure that's a whole nother session. One of the other issues, though, that makes antibacterials so not effective is, as I've already pointed out, the bugs don't stop. The bugs never stop. Our two newest gram-negative agents, ceftolozane tazobactam, ceftazidime avibactam, within a year and a half of release, we've already got cases in the literature of Pseudomonas figuring them out and other things figuring them out. Have you ever seen cholesterol that is resistant to Lipitor? I bet none of you have driven by the donut shop and went, not eating there, that cholesterol donut, that's resistant to Lipitor, right? So the problem is that antibiotics are a limited, finite resource, and you have crazy people such as myself running around trying to get you people to use less of them. So if you're in big pharma, where's the incentive to continue to develop these compounds? And so I think we really have to re-envision how we're incentivizing big pharma to stay in this game, because guys, you can't have untreatable bugs roaming around on your units. It is absolutely no fun. And there are places in this country and places in this world where that is the case today. So we've already talked a little bit about some of these organisms that are causing most of the problem. Again, notice that C. diff is sitting at the top of the list. But look, the thing that's really disturbing is these are all the usual suspects. And they are still the most common causes of healthcare-associated infections. So when these suspects become highly resistant and common, ooh, that is not really a good place to be. And when you look at carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas, because remember, Pseudomonas is what historically scares the bejesus out of us when it comes to febrile neutropenia. Notice that there are a lot of places in the country that are well in excess of 20% of their Pseudomonas isolates being carbapenem resistant. The other thing that we know is that when you have organisms that are more resistant, notice what it does to length of stay. Notice what it does to hospital costs. So not only are these bugs harder to treat, they keep you in the hospital longer, you cost more money, and unfortunately you're more likely to die with these. Patients who are found to have infections with carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae typically have a mortality rate of approaching 40%. That means 4 out of 10 of those patients leave the hospital through celestial discharge. Right? Which is not the way we like our patients leaving the hospital. The other point that I want to make is E. coli. This green bar and this green bar is E. coli. This is all the other bad gram-negative kids that we talk about and worry about. When you look at your antibiogram and you see that your institution has a 20% rate of E. coli resistant to fluoroquinolones, it becomes a big deal because the number of isolates that you see of E. coli every year is so high. Any significant resistance in E. coli whatsoever is a significant clinical problem because of the frequency with which that bug causes infections. And again, you don't have to be horribly immunocompromised for E. coli to be problematic in you, but if you are immunosuppressed, it enjoys you even more. Okay? So when we think about who's at risk for these multi-resistant gram-negative organisms, notice again that getting old is highly dangerous. Okay? So once more, we see that getting older is dangerous, but exposure to broad spectrum antibiotics, increasing numbers of antibiotics, older age, chronic disease, ICU, COPD, increasing duration of hospitalization. Does this sound like any patients you guys see? Right? Therein lies the problem. And I think that's why we need to be doing everything we possibly can to minimize antibiotic exposure in these patients and also to ensure that we get their white cells back in a timely fashion to try and minimize their infection risk. And again, this slide largely talks about what we've already kind of touched on, that basically across the board, whether it's cost, whether it's length of stay, whether it's mortality, everything gets worse when you have multi-resistant gram negatives causing the problem. The other thing that I want to remind you guys of is that when a patient appears septic in your ER or appears septic in your outpatient infusion center, realize that time is of the essence, okay? This is one of the reasons that the CMS's focus on sepsis as one of the core measures is such a big deal, because we know from this study and a couple of others, what I want you to notice here is the y-axis here, this is percent of patients who survive, okay? So notice within 0 to 0.5 hours, you've got about an 80% survival, and then it goes down, okay? And this is the effect of the time of antibiotic initiation over here. So if you're out in here and it took you 36 hours to get effective antibiotics on board, and this patient was septic, their survival rate is 5%. Okay? So basically, the way that this data rolls out is that for every hour of delay in effective antibiotic therapy in someone who has sepsis, you basically increase their mortality risk by 7%. Okay? So, time is of the essence when patients are hemodynamically unstable, critically ill. You need to be making sure that you're choosing appropriate antibiotics and getting them on board in a timely fashion. The other issue to kind of wrap up this fun-filled discussion section, how many of you have used or seen colistin? Okay, some of you. Colistin is basically intravenous Tide laundry detergent. It is thoroughly unpleasant. It was put on the shelves in the 1950s because it was, wait for it, more toxic than aminoglycosides. Okay, and aminoglycosides cause your kidneys to fall out and lay on the floor. Okay? So, it was a crappy drug in 1955, and it's a crappy drug now. But unfortunately, it was our last line for a lot of these resistant gram-negatives until we started feeding it to pigs in China. Okay? And so now what we have are organisms coming out of China that have basically spread globally that are colistin resistant. So, you know, again, coming back to the point that we have to be not only careful about how we use antibiotics in our patients, but also how we use antibiotics as a society, because really, we have really kind of burned it down to some of the last few options. So, you guys are now left in a clinical scenario. And I say you guys because I left the building as soon as I heard it was carbapenem resistant, all right? But really, you're dealing with a situation where you have increasing resistance rates and you have compromised patients who are at very high risks of developing these infections. Your immune system is clearly your friend, okay? And we know that we need to get that back. And we know that from long-term data that really neutropenia drives your infections, right? And the longer your neutropenia persists, the more likely you are to develop infection. Again, when you think about who is at high risk that you see in front of you, the first thing that predisposes to infection is immunodeficiency, neutropenia. But also, when you see folks with mucositis, when you see folks who have impaired organ function because of tumor burden or because of radiation to certain areas, you really need to be thinking about that. But the other thing that I think we don't think about quite enough sometimes is my personal favorite, and that's the medications. As I've pointed out, you guys are all, as we're sitting here, you guys have had 5 new agents approved for management of oncology. And the problem is with a lot of these MABs and MIBs, we don't really know the full extent of side effect profile until they're out in the clinical practice for a while. You know, it may inhibit CD1433, which again sounds like a droid from Star Wars, but, you know, it inhibits this, that, or the other. And we don't really know what that does until we knock it out. And then we go, oh, that's what that does, right? And we know what it does in the tumor, but it also kind of goes over here and does something we really didn't see coming. And so I think that that's really been one of the other challenges. The other thing is, if it moves, it gets a corticosteroid, right? I mean, it the number of people on this witch's brew is just off the hook. And, you know, big doses of steroids, fludarabine, alemtuzumab. See, I normally am not allowed to say these words at my hot institution. I go to the oncology pharmacist. I mean, you know that one, right? But, you know, you've got all these other agents out there that really result in some profound and different types of immunosuppression. The infection rates are driven by neutropenia. Again, one of the things that I want you to really think about is the speed of the decline, okay? When somebody's white cell count is dropping in a hurry, the speed with which that count is declining tends to oftentimes predict the duration of and the severity of the neutropenia. So when you see folks going down quickly, it's really time to see if you can do anything about it and to have a very low threshold to start thinking about infections. Because remember, a lot of immunosuppressed patients, especially if corticosteroids are in play or other agents are in play, a lot of the typical signs of infection that we think of may be masked. And again, you know, basically, we've got all these new drugs that we've talked about. We've got limited information on side effects. And again, this 4-letter word that starts with N or starts with C, ends with S, and sounds and has corticosteroid in between, okay, I think really is a group of drugs that we need. I think we get so comfortable flinging big doses of steroids around that sometimes we forget exactly how immunosuppressive these agents could be. So what do you do to prevent infections in these immunocompromised, complicated patients that you're taking care of? What about prophylaxis during neutropenia? Let's talk about this a little bit, okay? The quinolones are the best studied agents. They have the best data out there. They should not be used in low-risk patients. If you have patients with anticipated durations of neutropenia of less than or equal to 7 days, that means you solid tumor patients for the most part, don't be dropping fluoroquinolones on these people, okay? Because those short durations of neutropenia are not typically where people get into trouble. And we also know that the more you show folks quinolones, the more likely they are to colonize with quinolone-resistant stuff. The NCCN recommendations right now, again, suggest that you not go after these low-risk patients, but that really the intermediate and high-risk patients, folks who are expected to have neutropenias lasting longer than 7 days, or who have had problems with prior courses of chemo with regards to infection and febrile neutropenia are really the folks where we need to be thinking about quinolone prophylaxis and where there's pretty good data to support it. Now, again, I will be the first one to tell you that there's controversy in this area. You know, there is a lot of question about, okay, at what point do we hit an E. coli rate with quinolone resistance where the prophylaxis no longer works? Nobody really seems to know that answer right now. And there are a lot of institutions out there that are running 20 to 30% of their E. coli's being quinolone resistant. So, you know, I think that this is an area where we have to keep an eye on the field and the data as it moves along. The other thing, too, if you're dealing with stem cell transplant patients, I would highly encourage you to not forget about the pneumococcus. Okay, Streptococcus pneumoniae remains as nasty as it ever was, and penicillin prophylaxis is encouraged for out to a year in all allogeneic stem cell transplants, and you want to make sure that it's continued until immunosuppression for graft versus host disease is complete. The antifungals we're not really going to talk a lot about in the interest of time, but also realize that this is something that needs to be thought about in particular in our allogeneic stem cell transplant group. Other infections, pneumocystis, primarily be thinking about again in folks with big doses of steroids. Also, temozolomide. You know, basically temozolomide, brain tumor patients, we see a lot of steroids going on there. Thinking about PCP prophylaxis in those folks. Greater than 20 milligrams of prednisone for 4 weeks. There's a surprising number of patients who meet that cutoff. And pneumocystis can be downright nasty when it does pop up. We've already mentioned temozolomide a little bit. And remember, radiotherapy does a nice job of whacking a lot of the bone marrow where your cells basically come from. So again, I think this is an area where maybe we don't prophylax as many patients for this as we should. The antiviral prophylaxis, again, similar recommendations to up here, especially if folks have an incidence of HSV infections or recent VZV infections. CMV is very problematic, but again, primarily only for or mostly in our allogeneic stem cell transplant. This is the area where I really wanted to get to. This is an area that we need to be paying a lot of attention to. We've got good vaccines. We need to be using them. If we have people who we know are going to receive chemotherapy regimens, vaccinate them ahead of time, okay? Even if you only get partial response, it's way better than no response, which is what you will get if you do not vaccinate them. There are very, very good guidelines. NCCN has them. IDSA has them. If you've not been to the IDSA website and seen the vaccination guidelines for high-risk patients, idsociety.org, look at the guidelines tab. Okay, there's really good stuff out there for who should be getting vaccines. The other thing, though, is remember that some of these vaccines, such as varicella or zoster, all right, are live vaccines. You don't want to be giving live vaccines to people who are profoundly immunocompromised. So again, this is a really good thing to make sure you have or good reason to have that guideline document near you. This right here is impossible to read, but what I want you to take away is this. The NCCN guidelines are full of really good tables like this. And again, go to nccn.org and look at this. Nice stepwise flow charts here. And basically what this is the table talking about who can receive outpatient therapy for febrile neutropenia versus who needs inpatient management. This is all really nicely, clearly laid out. And a lot of our febrile neutropenia patients who are at low risk really even don't need hospitalization. What should you be thinking about, though, drug-wise, when you are presented with someone who has febrile neutropenia? In the low-risk patients, and again, I would strongly encourage you to go to the NCCN guidelines and look at that definition for low risk. The recommended regimen and the regimen I would encourage you to use is ciprofloxacin plus amoxicillin clavulanic acid, otherwise known as Augmentin. The big thing with amoxclav, guys, don't ever dose this stuff BID in people with normal renal function, okay? It needs to be 3 times a day, and remember that the ciprofloxacin dose here is 3 times a day as well. I really am not as big a fan of moxifloxacin because it doesn't have the Pseudomonas coverage that ciprofloxacin has, and it's, you know, maybe had some problems as compared to the other regimen. These are the agents that you really want to be thinking about for intravenous monotherapy in inpatients. It's your cefepimes, your piptazos, and your meropenems. Those are the places you need to be. Only be thinking about VANC in people who have gram-positive infections, line sites that are pussed out. We should not be hitting everybody with a big beta-lactam and vancomycin. Remember, vancomycin should be initiated in niche situations, gram-positive driven type situations. When people are actively trying to die on you or are very hemodynamically unstable, you again go with that gram-negative coverage, and you can consider adding an aminoglycoside for 1 or 2 doses while you figure out what's wrong. Because again, remember, the worst thing you can do in someone who is acutely septic is not have empiric coverage that gets the organism that eventually grows. You need to make sure that in patients who are septic, that your first choice antibiotics cover the organism that you eventually grow. So to wrap it up, the biosimilars are coming. You now have 4 on the market. A lot of you have already seen filgrastim out there as a biosimilar. I think this is a really good thing. I think it will minimize expenses for our patients, for our healthcare systems. The bugs, though, are increasingly problematic. You need to know what's going on in your institution. If you don't know where your antibiogram is, I want you on Monday to go find your antibiogram so you know what grows in your hospital and you know what your resistance rates are. Because I can tell you what's going on nationally, but you need to know what's going on in your institution. And again, appropriate prophylaxis and appropriate vaccination saves lives in profoundly immunocompromised patients or folks who are going to be immunocompromised for a long time. With that, I will thank you for being such a great audience after lunch. Have a great rest of your meeting.
Concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.